Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Al Franken, Democrat of Minnesota, is not one of those senators who plotted a career in politics from childhood. He graduated from Harvard and went straight to work as a writer and performer, most famously on the sketch comedy show Saturday Night Live.
Believe me, I know what it's like, laying there awake, all those tapes rolling. I'm a fraud. Tomorrow I'm going to be exposed for what I am, a big imposter. I just want to curl up and lay in bed all day and eat Fig Newton.
Franken's reputation as a funny man made some people doubt he could take a Senate seat seriously until he got there and earned a reputation as a workhorse and incisive questioner in Senate hearings. Here he is grilling Education Secretary Betsy DeVos during her confirmation.
Well, in terms of throwing numbers around, you said that student debt has increased by 1,000%
since 980% in 8 years.
I'm sorry?
980%.
That's just not so. It's increased 118% in the past 8 years.
Well,
so I'm just asking, if you're challenging my figures, I would ask that you get your figures straight.
Franken shares a lot of other backstage information about his second career in politics in his new memoir, Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. I sat down with him last week at KUT in Austin when Think went on the road for the Texas Tribune Festival. Senator Franken, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So as a baby boomer, you write about growing up at a time when a decent middle-class lifestyle just seemed like something everybody could have if they worked hard enough.
Yeah, it seemed like the birthright of Americans was that your kid would do better, your kids would do better than you. And yeah, I grew up in the 50s. My dad hadn't graduated high school. He was a printing salesman. We grew up in a suburb of Minneapolis. In a two-bedroom, one-bath house. I had, you know, my brother and me and my parents, and I felt like the luckiest kid in the world because I was. I was growing up, you know, middle class, at the height of the middle class in America, and I was growing up in Minnesota and in St. Louis Park, and I just felt like I could do anything. My wife grew up different. Her father, who's a decorated World War II vet, died in a car accident when she was 18 months old, and leaving her mom widowed with five kids at age 29, and she had a high school education, but they really struggled. You know, sometimes there wasn't enough food to eat. Actually, that was often. And the heat got turned off and the phone got turned off, but they did make it. They made it because of Social Security survivor benefits. All the girls, there were four of them, went to college on Pell Grants, and at that time, and scholarships. At that time, Pell Grant paid about 80% of a public college education. My mother-in-law went to college after the youngest, Bootsy, went to high school. She got a $300 GI loan and went to college for a year and then got three more, and she graduated and became an elementary school teacher. And because she taught Title I kids, poor kids, all her loans were forgiven. My brother-in-law went into the Coast Guard and became an electrical engineer, essentially. So they all made it in the middle class because of Pell Grants and Social Security survivor benefits and the GI Bill and, you know, Title I of the, I said my mother-in-law's loans were forgiven because she taught poor kids. So, you know, they tell you in this country to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, but first you have to have the boots, and the government gave Franny's family the boots, and that's one of the reasons, anyway, I'm a Democrat.
Well, let me interrupt you, because there are really two ways that you can go if you love someone who's been through that kind of hardship or you've been through it yourself. You can either say, this gives me a great amount of empathy for people who haven't come as far as I have, or you can say, there must be something wrong with people who haven't come as far as I have.
Well, I think that, first of all, there are people now who, after 40 years of seeing the middle class squeezed, and wages not going up. As I said, it was like a birthright that your kids would do better than you. People haven't felt that like that for a long time. And so they're angry. And they're angry at different things. And some are angry at people who they think are getting ahead of them in line. And this has to do with the anti-immigration stuff and some of the alt-right racist stuff. And then others are feeling like the economy is rigged. And it is. But maybe in a different way than certainly some of my Republican friends say it's rigged. So we have a argument on our hand, and our messaging sometimes isn't so great. And sometimes it isn't just about messaging. But I say in our book that Democrats' messaging, our problem is that all our bumper stickers end with "continued on next bumper sticker."
Meaning that there just isn't really good use of language, or meaning that
yeah.
it's too complex?
Well, both. Both. That we tend to be, you know, I think those of us on the Democratic side tend to think that government works and it should be made to work, and therefore we need to pay attention to policy. And I think President Trump is sort of the extreme version of that, which is that he, you know, is not interested in policy and also doesn't want to do the work of studying policy.
One of the things I really liked about this book is that you write about what it's actually like to be a senator. For one thing, you missed the orientation that freshman senators receive because it took a very long time to...
I got there 6 months late.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you had followed politics closely. You were doing political radio. I wonder what were the things you didn't know about the job until you had it?
I didn't know a lot. I didn't know how much you rely on staff. I didn't know exactly what your day was like. I didn't realize there was so little debate, real debate, that when you give a speech on the floor, there's usually no one there and no colleague there, their staff. That's why you can't tell a joke on the floor, by the way, because there's no one there to laugh. And
so it seems like you bombed when, in fact, there was just no audience.
Yeah, or you did bomb and there was no audience. There's that, too. But you know, but they're on a tight single of you on C-SPAN, and for all people know, there's 99 other colleagues there, and you tell, you know. So, you know, I didn't, and one thing I will say about this, people do comment of, well, you tell what it's really like to be a senator, and what it's, and I just want to caveat that with, this is my experience, you know, and I think that, in fact, Elizabeth Warren and Angus King both read the book and both said to me, and we haven't had this dinner yet, but that we need to get together and say, like, how do I approach it? Because they realize that I talk about my approach and my experience. And it's, I think all 100 have a slight, in some cases, common experiences. In some cases, we approach things differently. And it can depend on our state. You know, there are senators who are a state that's either heavily red or heavily blue, and they're basically going to get reelected, and they don't take as many constituent meetings as I do, you know, because, so I do a lot of meetings every day with people coming from Minnesota who, you know, might be the soybean growers or, you know, hospital association or, ethanol or energy, you know, all different kinds of groups. And I meet with as many as I can.
You came in the year Barack Obama was inaugurated. Does it feel palpably different in the Senate when the president of the United States is from a different party?
Yes. Yes. For a whole bunch of reasons. One of which is, you know, with the Obama administration, I had really strong relationships, friendships with many of the cabinet members. And so if I wanted to get something done that involves CMS, which is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, in under HHS, Health and Human Services, I could, you know, call Andy Slavitt, and he knew me. He's actually from Minnesota. And, you know, I, as it was, I talked to Seema Burma, who is now the CMS administrator, yesterday about a matter. And so it wasn't that much different, except that there's a slightly different relationship, let's put it that way. And so that's a big difference. We also now, when I got in there, we had 59 at first Democratic senators, and we had 60, which is very, very different than we have now, which is we have the small, the Republicans in the majority, and that makes a huge, huge difference in terms of what hearings are held or whether we have hearings and on all matters of thing.
How often are there genuine surprises in a vote?
Not that often. You know, every once in a while we get like Republicans wanted to overturn a rule on venting methane on, you know, government-owned land with the guys who were drilling oil and gas. And they vent the methane, which is actually much worse greenhouse gas than CO2. And we, you know, during the Obama administration, the Energy Department made a rule. I think it was the Energy Department or the EPA made a rule that you can't do, you can't vent it. You know, you got to collect it, and it's worth something. So, you know, and they did a congressional resolution in the House where you can overturn regulation, and they overturned it in the House, and then we had a vote on it. We won. I mean, by that, I mean, we kept the rule. And so we had a few Republicans defect. And then, of course, the McCain vote. It wasn't a total surprise to me. I kind of knew.
Talking about health care.
Yes. I'm sorry. That was on the last, most recent repeal and replace vote. And we're going to see what happens this coming week on this new iteration of Trump Care.
Graham Cassidy,
yeah. So that was, it wasn't a surprise at the moment that it happened because Pence wasn't there. And Pence had come to Vice President Pence. I should be respectful and call him Vice President Pence. And he had come, and he had been sitting in the chair when John McCain had made the vote to proceed to these votes. So I think he knew we had the 50 then, and he would cast the 50 first, or that they had the 50. And I saw him on the floor talking, and he left. And he went across the hall. There's an office for the vice president right across this narrow hall behind the Senate chamber. And I said, oh, well, if he's not in the chair, I don't think he's got the votes. So, and I'd heard from the leader, the minority leader, Chuck Schumer, that we had made a lot of progress on that. And you know, Senator McCain, in the speech he gave where he got a standing ovation, it was all about returning to regular order, to normal order, which is that you have hearings and you have witnesses and you have amendments. And this was the opposite of that process. So when he finally got to vote on it, was the skinny bill, and he just said no, and it made perfect sense.
My guest is Senator Al Franken, talking about his life in Congress and his latest book, Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. When we return, we'll continue our conversation about how Americans receive their health care.
We in this country didn't have don't completely have a healthcare system. If you're getting your healthcare through Medicare or Medicaid, you're in the Canadian system, single payer. If you're getting it through, if you're in the military or getting through the VA, you're in the British system, socialized medicine. If you get it through your employer, as most people do, then you are in the German system. But if you don't have any health insurance, you're in the Cambodian system.
That's after a short break.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest today is Senator Al Franken, who has a new book out called Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. Let's return to the conversation.
So now the Republicans are trying to push through Graham Cassidy, and they've got sort of a deadline, right, by the end of the month. If it doesn't get done by then.
Right. This is a reconciliation where you can pass something with 51 votes. And the parliamentarian ruled that they're still on the other, I don't know, rule or something that said they have to do this by September 30th.
Does it have a better shot than the skinny repeal?
I hope not. First of all, unravels the guarantees that are in the Affordable Care Act. It unravels guarantees on protecting people with pre-existing conditions, on lifetime caps and annual caps, that if you spend a certain amount of money in health care, your insurer can just say, nope, that's it. And that used to be the case before the Affordable Care Act. And just the essential health benefits, which is a list of things that every insurance policy has to have. So it has to have prescription drugs and hospitalization and mental health and all these different essential health benefits, where if they're going to allow states to let insurance companies not have all of those. And that means that if you have a pre-existing condition where you need one of those, you're not going to get that policy. You're going to have to buy a more expensive policy. So there'll be states where people with a pre-existing condition can buy insurance. They'll just be completely priced out of it. So and then it just gets rid of Medicaid as we know it. And again, the president said during the campaign, I'm not going to cut Medicaid. So that was a promise. Now, I've heard a Republican colleague say, well, there's 10 good reasons to vote against this bill, meaning substantive, actual policy reasons. But the one reason is that we promised to repeal and replace. Well, the president also promised during the campaign not to cut Medicaid. And this is going to be hundreds of billions of dollars of cuts in Medicaid. And this has consequences for people's health. And, and because we expanded Medicaid, rural hospitals had so much, less unpaid care. So someone go in the emergency room, they didn't have insurance. It was just the hospital had to eat it. Now with expanded Medicaid, the insurance company or Medicaid paid it. And as a result, rural hospitals have hired more people. There are lots of counties in Minnesota where the hospital is the largest employer. And in many cases, these hospitals may even have to shut down. But they definitely have to scale back the number of people they have. They're not going to be able to provide as good a care. And they're going to be people who lose their coverage. And that's really important. I have had people crying at round tables at rural hospitals because their mom gets their home health care through Medicaid at home. And a woman saying, like, my husband and I both work. We don't know what we're going to do. I don't think she can stay in her home. But on the other hand, about 2/3 of seniors' nursing home care comes through Medicaid. So this is going to affect real people. We had a Medicaid summit forum in Minnesota where we had different people tell their stories. We had a young man, 20 years old, he and his mom. He had been born very premature, weighed a little over a pound and a half when he was born. Doctors saved his life. They told his parents after the first 2 days they had spent over $1 million on his care, and they were terrified. And the nurses took them aside and said, "We signed him up for Medicaid. You're going to be fine." And this kid had cerebral palsy and hydrocephalus. He has a shunt and has had 30 some surgeries. He was there, Brandon, and he walked with a walker. But he's now 20 years old. He just told us he had just finished his first college course and got an A-. And there were about 200 people in this event. I'd say he was the person I was least worried about.
You are one of 15, 16 Senate Democrats who are now openly talking about Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All proposal, sure, which is a single-payer system.
Yep.
First, I have to ask, is this something you thought was a good idea all along, but now it's safe to say it out loud?
Well, I've said the same thing all along, and I say this in my book. There were some of us who were for single-payer in 2009, but you needed 60 votes, and we were about 55 votes short.
Mm-hmm.
So, look, every other country has universal, every developed country has universal health care. They do it in different ways. But we need to cover everybody. The Affordable Care Act was what we could do at the time, and I think it was a very good, you know, when I was debating in for the Senate in 2008, my first campaigning as Norm Coleman, he would say, well, we have the best healthcare system in the world because we have Mayo Clinic. And I'd say, well, you know, a hospital isn't a healthcare system. A clinic isn't a healthcare system. And we in this country didn't have and don't completely have a healthcare system. If you're getting your health care through Medicare or Medicaid, you're in the Canadian system, single payer. If you're in the military or getting it through the VA, you're in the British system, socialized medicine. If you get it through your employer, as most people do, then you are in the German system. But if you don't have any health insurance, you're in the Cambodian system. And what we did with Obamacare was get as many people as we could who were in the Cambodian system, in the one of the other systems, and Medicaid expansion got them in the Canadian system, the individual market got them into a system that we have in Switzerland and other France and other systems where you can buy into insurance.
The Kaiser Family Foundation estimated the healthcare industry was worth $3.2 trillion in 2015. I looked and looked for exact figures on how much the healthcare, the health insurance industry is part of that, and I couldn't find exact figures, but I think it's edging up close to $1 trillion. If we had a single-payer system, and I realize that this is far off if it happens at all, what would happen to the private insurance industry? There are a lot of people employed in that,
sure,
and a lot of people who have come to depend on the way that healthcare system works.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think there will be a system of private insurance still to augment your Medicare for All. They have those in many other countries. Then people who are displaced, who are in that, can get training for other careers. And there will presumably take some of the skills that they have. And I mean, there's a lot of IT people in it. There's a lot of, they will have to take that and maybe do something else with it. And I know that will be, you know, we have insurance companies in Minnesota. We tend to have non-profit insurance companies that do coverage in Minnesota. But yeah, that's going to be a disruption, but if we do this gradually, you know, there's different ways to do this. When I was running in 2008, I said, why don't we just put every kid into Medicare, essentially? So 0 to 18, you're in Medicare, because we all believe in, you know, taking care of kids, and kids have pretty low actual healthcare costs. So do that. And then at some point bring it down to 55 for, when the first group that's 18 turns 19, they just keep it. And so I was trying to think of a way in which to get there, which is less disruptive. So, and actually Bernie's legislation does that kind of transition as well.
Medicare expenditures are still growing at 4.5% a year, which is more than twice the rate of inflation right now. How long continue if that is the rate of expansion and we want to make Medicare much bigger?
Well, we're going to have to make Medicare bigger because people like me.
I'm talking about I'm talking about Medicare for all. If you're saying the numbers of people and the expenditures are growing well above the rate of inflation.
Yeah, but actually less than the growth in the rest of the healthcare system. So actually under that logic, it's cheaper.
But the government's paying instead of private individuals.
Well, yeah, but we would look. Every other country that has universal health care, every other developed country, they do it for less than we do, like a lot less, for somewhere between half and two thirds, and they have just good outcomes. So I don't buy the argument that this is going to cost us our health care system more. I think there'll be Medicare is a lot more efficient, and Medicaid is more efficient than the private healthcare system.
You mentioned earlier learning how much you had to rely on your staff to sort of keep up with things. That it's
sure.
Something that you describe in the book. You're not supposed to credit your staff for their good ideas
right.
or for
helping
you stay
informed. I got yelled at.
First of all, why are you? Are voters supposed to believe that you, Senator Al Franken, are sort of omniscient?
Yes.
Do you think that's working?
Yes, we're trying to send that message. Now, basically, we had one piece of legislation. I got an early victory right away, and it was a kind of a contentious issue, and we had a press conference, and they said, who had this idea to do this? And I went, oh, my chief of staff. And when we got back to the office, he went, never do that! Never give the staff credit! And, you know, I was a writer. I was, like, a comedy writer, and we used to, whoever wrote the thing got the credit for writing it, you know, and very often pieces were co-written, and we were meticulous. The person who thought of the idea, his initials or her initials were first, then the person who contributed the next most. Sometimes you had three, four writers on something. So my ethic was you give credit to whoever had the idea. Well, no. The staff is here because of you.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Senator Al Franken.
And basically in the book, I talk about how it's all staff, you know, and because you have so much to do and you have so much committee work. I'm on health, education, labor, and pension. That's one committee. Not very important unless you care about your health or your family's health. And if you care about your education, your kids' education, whether you plan to work at some point in your life and want to retire. That's all that one covers. Then there's, I'm on energy and natural resources, and I'm on the judiciary, which has a very wide-ranging portfolio, and I'm on Indian Affairs. And so I have staff for all of these, and they're preparing me briefings all the time, but they know this stuff better than I do. And when we do legislation, I'm, relying on them very often. It's ultimately, these things are my decisions about what we do. And I pick them, and I won the election, and I meet with all the constituents. I know more than any single staff member does about what we're doing. I'm the only one who goes back and forth to Minnesota all the time. I'm the one who's in the caucus lunches. I know what my colleagues are talking about and thinking about. I mean, so it's all staff, but it all comes from the top also.
You write about the fact that as a courtesy, when you were going to share a story about a Senate colleague, you would let him or her know that they would appear in the book. And I guess you gave them veto power if they didn't want the story told.
Yeah, all but Cruz.
And we'll talk about him in a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
how much of what happens in the Senate is off the record? And how different would our perception be of that body if we could see your colleagues the way you do?
Well, it's a courtesy. I mean, I extended this courtesy to everyone except for Cruz, and I justify that, by the way, I think convincingly in the book. And but the funniest was Coburn, Tom Coburn, senator from Oklahoma, very very conservative, very kind of big Federalist. Everything go back to the states. He was called Dr. No. That was his nickname in the Senate because he was an obstetrician gynecologist, and he basically put holds on things to slow things down and screw things up. And when he felt like he, so he's called Dr. No. So and he has really not a big, not a good sense of humor. So my first interactions with him, and he was on Judiciary when I first got there, were not good. They weren't terrible.
You can connect.
Did not connect. He didn't get me. So I said, Tom, can I take you to lunch? He said, well, you can take me to breakfast. So I went to breakfast a couple days later in the Senate dining room, sit down about 8 a.m. And I say, look, Tom, for the next 40, 45 minutes, whatever this is, let's just have fun, okay? He goes, okay, fun. And I said, we can talk about anything. We can talk about our families, talk about politics, talk about our careers before the Senate. He said, okay. And I said, but let's have fun. He goes, okay, fun. So I said, careers. Let me ask you something. To be a doctor in Oklahoma, do you have to have any formal education? And he says, yes, you've got to go to medical school. And he just erupted, and I went, okay, I think I've identified our problem. That was a joke, you see. And that's what I used to do in my career. I used to do jokes. And then he got that, and then we had a delightful breakfast. And several years later, I'm writing this book, and I call him. He's in retirement. You know, Tom, how you doing? Oh, I'm good. How are you? I'm good. Remember that breakfast we had where, you know, I asked you, oh, yeah. I said, I was wondering if I could use that story in the book. And he went, we have a First Amendment. You can write anything you want.
And there the story is.
And that's sort of it.
My guest is Senator Al Franken, talking about his life in Congress and his latest book, Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. When we return, Franken talks about his relationships with fellow members of Congress, including the junior senator from Texas.
The thing you should know about Ted Cruz is that I probably like Ted Cruz more than most of my colleagues like Ted Cruz, and I hate Ted Cruz.
That's after a short break.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest today is Senator Al Franken, who has a new book out called Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. Let's return to the conversation. When I asked Franken about why Texas Senator Ted Cruz reminds him of Dwight Schrute, a character from the sitcom The Office.
So you acknowledge Senator Cruz's, our senator from Texas, his extraordinary intellect, which everyone who's ever met him is struck by that.
Yes, you acknowledge, very smart.
You acknowledge the fact that he, in fact, does have a sense of humor, makes jokes.
Yes.
But you call
he
him
values humor.
You call him the Dwight Schrute of the Senate, and you describe him as a toxic coworker.
Yes.
Not just for you, but for your Republican colleagues as well?
Yes. Yeah.
Why?
He just got there and just made enemies all over the place. And I tell a story in which he just completely talk about the gun debate, and in it he just lies like a couple times. You know, I mean, he just, and is awful, just awful in certain ways. But I say the thing you should know about Ted Cruz is that I probably like Ted Cruz more than most of my colleagues like Ted Cruz, and I hate Ted Cruz. And he just to get things done in the Senate, you have to be collegial. You have to, your word has to be good.
He doesn't care if people like him or not.
Evidently not. I mean, he said that. I think he's acting a little different. Maybe he read the chapter and went, you know what? He's right. And I hate it, but, gee, I didn't realize this. And I was, you know, pissing everybody off. And so to get anything done in the Senate, you've got to get along with people. And I do a lot of legislation with people I disagree with almost all the time. But I have collegial, you know, John Cornyn and I do legislation together all the time.
I interviewed Justice Stephen Breyer last year, and he was at pains to point out that although the average American thinks of the Supreme Court as very much split along ideological lines, a great deal of the things that the court rules on are unanimous. How frequently does something happen that something passes through the House and the Senate that everyone agrees is a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, it happens a lot. It happens all the time. And let's talk about something that John Cornyn and I worked on. This is called the Justice Mental Health Collaboration Act. And it was a reauthorization of something from, you know, that's been going on for a long time, which is mental health courts. And because there are people going to prison who have mental illness who really don't belong in prison. They just get worse in prison and come out dangerous, more, you know, it may be dangerous when they weren't dangerous, or it doesn't serve anybody to have them in prison. And then there's something called crisis intervention training, which gives police and corrections officers, so law enforcement, training on what it looks like when somebody, when they have entered a situation where someone is, it's energized by mental illness. And this works, and we updated this thing, got funding for it, and it essentially passed unanimously through both the Senate and the House. And it's just a good thing. And we had we had testimony in judiciary from a Texas law officer who teaches crisis intervention training, and he just testified to how much it saves lives. And it saves a lot of effort sometimes. Like, guys, I visited a corrections, St. Cloud State, which is the prison, which is where they intake everybody. They said, I was talking to a guy who had crisis intervention training. He said, you know how on those shows on the weekend, they'll show, they'll show a prison, and they'll show you going in there, and the guards having to suit up and get these pads on and, you know, wrestle, you know, just go in there and tackle a guy and get him to the ground. And he's going, he says, sometimes you can just talk to him. we learned this through the crisis intervention training, and it saves a lot of wear and tear on us. And the same thing is true. I mean, I talked to a policewoman. I asked for a garden variety story about how anyone had used this as a suburban police station, and this woman had the training. She said, well, garden variety story, let's see. About a few months ago, I was out on the street and I heard some screaming, and I thought it was a domestic dispute, but it wasn't. It was this woman was screaming, and I approached her, and she went to a railing and hung over this playground park. It was a big drop. She wouldn't have killed herself, but she got badly hurt, and I recognized what was going, you know, this is mental health illness. And I talked her down or up, or she got off the railing, and she said that she had been sexually abused as a child, and the abuser had left the community, but now he'd just come back. And I said, I know where I think you could get help. And she said, about 3 months later, I was working, an outdoor event and street fair, and the woman came up to me and said, you saved my life.
Wow.
And I said, so that's a garden variety story. She said, yeah, I use this all the time. I'll holster my gun maybe once in my career. But this is something I use like every day. And so this was completely bipartisan, but John Cornyn and I led the thing through.
When there is a lot of partisan rancor, it doesn't sound like, or maybe you just don't describe the times when it really gets under your skin and feels personal. What does it take to still think of someone as a friend and colleague when they have undermined something you care very deeply about and have worked very hard on?
Well, it depends on why they did it and how they did it. And If they did it through a sincerely held belief, that's one thing. They did it if they were straight with you, that's another thing. We have different, may oftentimes, belief systems, you know, and so that's fine. I just, on this new Graham Cassidy bill, a colleague of mine who I like very much said something I thought was terrible. He said, well, there are 10 reasons, I named 10 good reasons to vote no on this bill because things are so bad and it's just such a bad bill. I said, but, you know, we did promise to repeal and replace, so I guess that's the reason I'm going to vote for it. And I went, oh, that's terrible because it's going to hurt people so much. And also, there were other promises. There was the promise that Trump made not to cut Medicaid. And this is going to cut Medicaid by hundreds of billions of dollars and really hurt people. And so what about that promise? So, but, you know, and I think I'll talk to my colleague about this. He's not on the health committee. And I think he doesn't understand maybe the ramifications of those 10 reasons to vote against it.
What does 2018 look like for the Democrats?
I don't know. I'm not a prognosticator. You know, I've read my history and midterms for a president who's not particularly popular tend to usually be bad. There's been so much gerrymandering in this country. You know, you'll see states like in Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania where there are Republican state legislatures and Republican governors where if you add up all the popular votes of all the votes that candidates for the House of Representatives got, Democrats will win by a couple points and the delegations will be 2-1 Republican. And part of that is gerrymandering. A lot of it is, but part of it is just the way we sort, you know, ourselves. I think I'm here in Austin. I feel like I'm in a kind of an island here in Texas. I don't think that's a new observation. So there's that too. It isn't all gerrymandering. But I think this, So I think it's going to be hard for us to take back the House, and it's going to be hard for, we have 25 Democrats up in the Senate, so it's going to be hard for us to hold our number where we are right now, let alone take the majority. That said, I just don't know. That's over a year away. We've all seen in the last election how things can change and how we can be wrong about things and spell things. You know, so don't look at me, even though you are.
You're right across the table. I don't know if you had the actor's nightmare when you were making your living as a performer where suddenly you're thrust out on a stage and you don't know the lines and you have to sort of make things up as you go along.
Right. Chris Durang wrote a great play, a one-act play that is. It's a hilarious play. But yes, no, you know what? I had the writer's nightmare. I have it, still have it. It's Tuesday night at Saturday Night Live, and I can't think of anything.
Is there a senator's nightmare?
Oh yeah, senator's nightmare. Yeah, there's some horrible thing happening. You have no idea what to do. But that's not while you're sleeping.
So that's a waking nightmare.
That's when you're awake.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Senator Al Franken.
You say that Lindsey Graham is the funniest Republican in the Senate.
Yeah, he is. Again, Lindsey's a friend, and I hate what he's doing now, but with this bill, this iteration of Trump Care. But no, Lindsey, I like him a lot, and right in the middle of the Republican primary season, when he was like 15th out of 17, I said to him, Lindsey, you know, if I were voting in the Republican primaries, I'd vote for you. And he just said, that's my problem.
Do you think that President Trump, I know you don't want to prognosticate, but I'm going to ask you again. Do you think that President Trump has a good shot at re-election? No one thought many people didn't think that he would be
president. Well, wait a minute.
Today.
I said I couldn't predict 18. Now I'm
18. Now you're moving forward to 20.
Yeah. So I'm, you know, I have no, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
Do you imagine that he will run again?
I don't know. I don't know. There's all kinds of scenarios, aren't there? I mean, there's a scenario that he's not the president anymore. There's a scenario that he, and there are scenarios where he's not the president anymore that include things other than impeachment, where he just quits or something. But this is a very odd president. This is someone who is outside the norms. So I don't know about whether he's going to run for re-election, and if he does, I do not know what things are going to be like in 2020. I did not think he was going to win the last election, although I will say that I was very nervous on election day. I was on Morning Joe, and I followed Jennifer Granholm, the former governor of Michigan, who I respect a lot, and she was giddy, saying, oh, this is going to be a historic day, the first woman. And then I went on, I said, don't know. Every Democrat, you vote, because I'm the poster boy of close elections. I won by 312 votes. And
first time.
The first time. The second time I won very comfortably. And that's when I said, okay, I can be funny again.
Minnesota
Am
is...
I right about that? Of course.
Minnesota is just north of Iowa. Do you plan to spend a lot of time there in the next few years?
We're building a wall.
To keep out the Iowans?
Yeah, they're a bunch of drug dealers and criminals.
Well, now you've really alienated Iowa, so I guess the question I can ask you about whether this book is a test balloon.
No.
It's not something that you
want. No. Don't want to run for president.
Why not?
I think the president should be someone who wants to be president. And that's not... I didn't think I was going to do this. I didn't think I was going to be a senator. Paul Wellstone, my friend who died in a plane crash in 2002, you know, he said that politics isn't about power. It isn't about winning for the sake of winning. It's not about money. It's about help. It's about improving people's lives. And that's what I'm doing this for. I know that the president is in better position to do that, but that's just not a job I have ever thought about doing. I've seen the presidency up a little closer as a senator than as a comedian, and it's a heavy duty job, unbelievable pressure, and I'm not sure that's why. I don't think my family doesn't want me to do that, and I just that's no. No.
Senator Franken, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for making time for us.
Chris, thank you. This is a lot of fun.
That was my conversation with Senator Al Franken, whose latest book is called Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director with help on today's show from David Alvarez. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. We'll be right back.